it helped me to look at school refusal, which is very common now, as actual like children trying to advocate for themselves, children putting a line in the sand and saying, actually, no, I deserve to be treated better than this. I'm an autonomous human being. I deserve to have my own thoughts and to be able to express myself. I am not going to put myself into a toxic situation.
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
An anthropological,
biological,
cross-cultural,
evolutionary,
and physiological approach to childhood from preconception to adulthood.
So I'm Lucy Aitken-Reed. I share my life with two children, Ramona, who is 11, and Juno, who is just about to turn 9, and they've never been to school. So I guess the last decade has been experiencing life outside of the institution of mainstream education. And in recent years, over the last 3 years, I've been specifically working with parents of children who don't go to school to help them with the de-schooling process, unlearning conditioned beliefs about learning that and life and living that stop them from really diving into trust and joy. So that's my work these days. And I guess really one of my great passions and beliefs is that we could all be living life with so much more trust and joy. Sort of, I feel like I'm talking about a motto for my life. I don't know why I went there. Very strange. So I'm Lucy Aitken-Reed, and that's my motto. So strange.
Oh, I love that. What a great introduction. So you're living in New Zealand now, but you're originally from the UK. Can you tell us a brief story of how you came to be here?
Yeah, I can. It is kind of a long story, but I'll try and keep it brief. So we were living and working in London. We had Ramona and we loved our London lives. Me and him were both working for charities, but they were quite traditional in some ways. We had committed to a sort of feminist version of traditional life. So we were both working half-time hours so we could both raise our daughter equally. But there was still a kind of tradition about it. Like we'd wake up, join the commute, have to make enough money to pay a mortgage and squeeze in kind of wild living into the little corners we could find, like weekends and holidays. Mm. And then when our youngest, Juno, was born, we felt like we were putting so much energy into the weekends and the holidays. And actually what we really wanted was an experience of wild, liberated living that was an everyday thing and that wasn't so hard to find. So at that point, we packed up our house and went traveling in a van around Europe, learned a lot of lessons, and really just used it as a time to reimagine what our life could be like. We ended up in New Zealand, where my husband is from. And yeah, that was 8 years ago now. And then we spent the last 8 years doing various things, but mostly living off grid. Living in yurts, growing gardens and raising our children with as much wildness as we possibly can.
So was it your travels around Europe that led you to your alternative life of unschooling and yurt living with community? Because you were living at quite a pretty ordinary city dwelling life in London, right?
Yeah, we were, but our values were sort of still very similar. So even in the middle of London, from the outside, it might have looked like we were kind of normal. But the reality was we had a family bed. We were all co-sleeping. I was tandem breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. We were attachment parenting. So I was already reading all the right things. I was already a big fan of the continuum concept. Mm-hmm. That was already sort of starting to make me question what we were going to do around learning choices for Ramona, but I hadn't really decided. But I was definitely, it wasn't sort of like from woe to go. I was definitely percolating questions and the idea of living a bit more radically, but traveling around Europe and staying with different people and seeing different situations certainly crystallized it. So we visited a Wald Kindergarten, like a forest kindy in the Black Forest in Germany, and I was reading John Holt's How Children Learn, a kind of classic unschooling book. So I was reading that. And then every day we were showing up to the Wald Kindergarten to observe what was happening there. And there was just something really magical about that combination, sort of having the academic part of my brain being stirred by the book, but then seeing it in reality on the ground, these young kids navigating their life so graciously and learning everything they needed to learn. It was very, very impactful. And really from that moment, I knew that the girls would probably never go to school.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That sounds so beautiful. And then when you came to New Zealand, were you able to find an unschooling community quite easily? Or has it been like a long time?
No, it was easy. We jumped right off the plane. I did a Google search, unschooling New Zealand. And came across a camp that was happening in 3 weeks. So we didn't have a home, we didn't have a car, we didn't have any idea where we were going or what we were doing, but we knew that unschooling was going to be central to our values over the next few years. So we just booked our tickets for the camp and rocked up at the camp and immediately found a community, a family in a way, of people who shared so many of the same core values and visions for their lives and their children. And some of those people, many of them that we met back then 8 years ago, are, you know, rock solid core friends to us even now.
Wow.
And eventually those links led to us finding a family who we ended up buying land with, and it was the start of a beautiful thing. So yay for Google. People get down on the internet, no need. Good Google can change your life.
I love that you were able to use that, the unschooling community, to find another family to live with. Can you tell me what it was like, you know, living with another family? Because you both had a yurt on a piece of land together, is that right?
Originally, we were just living in somebody else's yurt, and it was on somebody else's land, and the two families were sort of working the veggie gardens in exchange for a place to live. So it was sort of a very low pressure way of trying out community living and intentional living. Mm-hmm. And we learned a lot and really got to get to know this family in a very real way. It wasn't just we weren't just showing each other our best, wittiest, nicest selves. You know, when you're living and working with each other, you really see the full picture. And that gave us a real confidence that we could go more long term and a bit more serious with them. So after a couple of years, we ended up purchasing land with the other family that had been in this temporary situation. And then we've been building that for the last 6.5 years.
So with the land that was owned by somebody else, was there ever a bit of a hierarchy with the owners, you know, kind of, I guess, dictating how they wanted the how they wanted you guys to garden or to tend the land, or was there anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say that it's something to be aware of. I do sometimes, when I'm talking about intentional communities with people who are heading into that, I definitely tell them to consider the power dynamics if somebody is the single owner and then other people are renting. Sometimes it can work really, really well, and sometimes it can be tense. and you have to have lots of conversations. There might be a little bit less autonomy, and if that's really important to you, you know, it's something to consider.
Yeah. And once you decided to live on another piece of land with this other family, how did that go? Was it, I guess you'd already known each other for a while, but I don't know, were there ever times when you just wanted a bit of space, or did you all get along relatively well for the most part?
Yeah, well, these are great questions. It went really smoothly in a way because we'd already been through quite a lot together. So we did have, you know, tense times, particularly around the kids. You know, when you're both attempting to raise children with as much kind of liberation and self-direction and autonomy and respect as possible, you know, you do go through things and you do experience things, but we always had an utmost trust in the family and the other family. We knew that they cared for us and cared for our children. So there was a real basis of trust that meant that when there was some tension or some conflict between the kids, we really knew that we were bringing our best, most honest and compassionate selves to the situation. So it was actually, even though, you know, there were tricky times, and I think that if you're going into community, you absolutely need to recognize, even predict, that there will be tension and conflict. But it really helps if you can have a basis of trust, if you can really expect the other family or the other person in the conflict to that they are doing their best, and that they are, you know, trust their good intentions and have good intentions for them. And that kind of basis got us through so much. We had a recent conflict a couple of years ago that felt really heavy, and it was funnily enough sort of about, we were sharing a lot. We were trying to run a business together, so we were sharing livestock, and it was sort of about cows in a way, which is funny to look back. But there were a few moments over those couple of months where I thought, I'd be lying in bed and I'd think, I am not evolved for community. Why does anybody do this to themselves? I just want to, I've got enough on my plate, you know, that sort of thing. And then the fact that we managed to get through the conflict and come out the other side with even more love and respect for each other actually restored my faith in community all over again, you know, because there were a few moments in that conflict where I was like, we're never going to get through this. And then we did, because we kept showing up, and it was very encouraging.
I guess it sounds like both families had similar worldviews and similar sort of parenting approaches, because I kind of picture it as being similar to having neighbours, but I guess it's more so than that. You're closer than that, is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't at all a neighbourly relationship, because we were it was a very intimate relationship. You just, maybe some people have neighbours like that, but I don't think it's very normal, you know, so there maybe was a little bit of an old school neighborly vibe about it. Like, not a week would pass by where one of us wasn't sending a kid round to the other person's house to get the soy sauce or the curry powder or, you know, like, missing ingredients from dinner. We were constantly helping each other out with food items. And I guess maybe people did have neighbours like that in the 50s. But, you know, we were also running a farm together. We were running unschooling events, camps, groups. You know, it was a very, very intimate relationship. And I think there are intentional communities out there where it is like having good neighbours. But this was definitely one that was more than that.
And were your children similar ages?
Their kids are a couple of years older, but yeah, they're really, really good friends. Well, they are really, really good friends. Ramona and Gino count them as their siblings.
Oh, that's sweet. Okay, now, so living in a yurt with, you know, two young kids, did you ever struggle with everyone living in the same, you know, one room space?
I don't think I did. I felt it was evolutionarily correct. You know, I it felt to me like this was how my ancestors would have lived. Mm. And, you know, so we would be making dinner, eating, watching, talking, playing, everything in one room. Like the kids were always within just a few meters of me.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a few years, I really did feel like that was the way we should be living. And it helps our children to feel really safe and secure. And I just feel like our kids are meant to be close to us. And we kind of have pathologized that in modern life. And we think that we should be sending kids off and away. And actually, I think we're all designed to be much closer to our family than, you know, modern life usually suggests we should be. You know, so I actually loved it. Tim probably could have done with a little bit more space. And in time, we did create a little studio where I went off to work, which was much better. Recommend having, if you're working from home, your own dedicated space. Right. So, you know, that changed things a bit. And it could also be a place where Tim could go off and get his sensory needs for quiet kind of met. Mm-hmm. I used to just do some simple things too, like I would be listening to a podcast in my earphones while the kids were playing, or if they had friends over and they were playing really raucously, I would just put in earplugs as a way of being able to hear them and respond to them, but not being triggered by the really loud sound. So I kind of figured out ways, I guess, to make it work really well for us all.
That's great. Now, yeah, what you said before about how you're closer to your family than modern life allows, how traditionally that's how we would have been, it's a great segue for my next question, which is just asking, you know, what other alternative parenting paths you've followed. You mentioned before about breastfeeding and co-sleeping. Yeah, I'd just like to hear your thoughts about those other aspects as well.
Yeah, so I think I'm a huge fan of attachment parenting. I really believe that that attachment theory and recognizing that children are born needing a strong attachment figure in their life, I feel like that information is critical for our world. You know, I really trust and believe and have seen evidence that if children can feel loved and accepted and nourished in those early years of their life, then they will grow up with much better ability to connect, communicate, to feel good within themselves, and to treat other people empathetically. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of attachment parenting. How that looks these days, I would probably be a little bit more like suggesting for parents to know themselves very well. You know, I was probably slightly militant attachment parenter back in the day. You know, we still sort of co-sleep, if I'm honest. We've only just started having the kids in their own beds. I tandem breastfed until the girls were four, you know, and I probably would have said that baby wearing and co-sleeping and breastfeeding is absolutely essential. Mm. And I think, you know, if you can do those things, brilliant. But I also think there's so much more space for people to be deeply attached, deeply connected, deeply nourishing with their babies and their children, whilst honoring the lives that they do lead or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I understand. And I guess how you guys were living with having another family there and other children to play with, it possibly made it easier to be able to do all of those things, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, and we were purposeful about it. It was one of the reasons we joined with another family, because we were all kind of trying to raise our children in an attached, empathetic and respectful way. Mm. And we were all aware that if we wanted to be able to do that, we need as much of a village as possible. And, you know, one way to get that village vibe is by living together. We did also have a village in London, though. So it's not only people in intentional community that can make this a priority in their life. You know, when we lived in London, we had two families that lived just 30 seconds away. And we were constantly in and out of each other's houses. Our kids grew up together up until Ramona was 2.5. You know, if one of us got locked out of our house, it was often me. I knew I had somewhere to go with my kids, you know, so it's not something that is only for people who can end up living together. Yeah. I feel like it, if you really want to raise kids in a countercultural way, in a radical way, there has to be a commitment to finding people around you who will support that and help you design that kind of life where your kids have playmates and you can get nourishment from the adult company.
Yeah, I really like how you included that, how you're able to still make community work in a city. So yeah, it's important to reassure people of that. And now, I was reading through your website and you also did like Nappy Free as well.
Oh yes, I forgot about that one. Yeah, I mean, that one was a big deal with Ramona, my eldest, because I'd never heard of it in my life. It was a very radical thing to do, but honestly, by the time Juno came along, it was so natural, it was almost not a thing. I completely about it. But I'm also a big fan of elimination communication, it as an extension of attachment communication, you know, keeping your kids in touch with their bodily urges and needs. We had a wild time with Nappy Free World.
Yes, it's such a great way to, because I've done it with my two children as well, but it's just such a great way to connect and understand your children's needs on this additional level, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was so into it with Ramona, it was ridiculous. I was like a Nappy Free evangelical. I'd sort of like, my friends would be observing the journey, you know, from afar, like, what on earth is Lucy doing? And then whenever I saw them, I'd be like, Ramona did 5 wees today in the toilet, you know, about my 7-month-old baby. I was so attached and so proud of this thing we were on. I would say probably way too much. But it was actually so cool. And by the time Juno came along, it was just completely normal and natural. It was an absolute non-thing. We just, in the same way I just breastfed her and wore her in a sling, we'd just give her plenty of opportunity to go to the toilet, and she did it. And for both children, it meant that potty training didn't exist. They just went around, both of them, between 15 months and sort of 20 months, somehow, without us really even being aware of it, they just went to being completely toilet trained.
Yeah.
With no dramas, no coercion, no reward system, you know?
And I guess it makes it easier before they get to that age, you know, they call it the terrible twos, but that sort of need of, at around the age of wanting to be more independent and trying to teach them at two when they're trying to do their own sort of thing. They've already got it figured out before then.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it just makes sense, I think. It's seen as absolutely bonkers.
Now, you are no longer actually living, we were just talking before we started recording this, you're no longer living on the land in the yurt. Could you want to just tell us briefly about your move to town?
Yes, so about a year ago, yeah, we just sort of started feeling a little bit of intuition around needing to be someplace a bit more connected to social infrastructure. For Ramona's sake, Ramona is our eldest. She is has a very social disposition. She just wants to play and engage with people. And up until that point, I'd sort of seen it as one of her quirks of her personality, this kind of independence and desire to make her own plans and have a gazillion friends around her at all times. I'd sort of just seen it as a quirky thing. Mm-hmm. And then I actually began looking at it in a different light and began seeing her social skills as a real competency and even as a zone of genius. And one of the things about unschooling is our role as parents is to pay attention to where our children come alive and where their zone of genius is. So when I began to look at it through that light, I began to see that it was actually really tricky to let her shine in this area on a farm in the middle of nowhere. So we'd signed up to tons of activities. We were spending 2 days in our local city, which was a big, massive drive away. I was constantly organizing play dates for her. And it just began to feel really out of balance. So, yeah, we followed up the little intuitive voice and moved to a little tiny town for 2 months. But then lockdowns meant that it became 4 months. And by the end of 4 months, we were feeling fairly sure that this was a place we wanted to commit to for the next season. I call it a season because I don't know if it's going to last for 1 year. Or if it's going to be for 5, we're not giving up the land or the yurts or anything at the moment. There is a beautiful little unschooling family caring for our yurts, and they are living their best life, and they've got a beautiful community with our co-owners. So at this stage, everything is feeling very mutual and kind of magical. And Ramona is thriving, and we're just loving this kind of experiment of living in town and trying to live out our values in a very different circumstance. So it's quite an adventure.
Yeah. And is Juno also enjoying it?
Yeah, Juno loves it. She has quite a few friends. She's definitely the one that misses our land more than anyone. She speaks about it on a weekly basis, and early on when we were talking about it, she was like, absolutely not, I'm not leaving the land. And then she made an agreement where she would only move if we could put the yurt up in the garden and she could live in the yurt. She's quite attached to, you know, that way of life.
Yeah.
I can even remember when we were on our land and we upgraded to a flushing compost toilet instead of just a bucket toilet. Juno was really mad then. She's a true off-grid wildling. But actually now Juno's made so many friends, and is actually, she's been slower to come around, but she actually really loves it now too.
Nice. And yeah, so I want to hear some more about unschooling in your family. But first, I heard you mention on another podcast the notion that traditional school is akin to like a toxic relationship. And I'd really love to hear you break this thought process down for us.
Yeah, so I first began thinking about this when I was considering myself as a teenager. I was a bit of a rebel as a teenager, and I spent most of my life feeling just slightly bad for what I was like as a teenager. I was always bunking school. When I was about 15, I hardly ever went to school. I was always just on the beach or down at the arcade. And I've always sort of been like, oh, seeing myself in a naughty light, like, oh, naughty teenage Lucy. And I was thinking about this a couple of years ago, and I could see it in a different light. I was like, what if that was the best thing I could have done for myself as a teenager? What if not going to school, where I was bored out of my brain, treated like crap. You know, my teacher threw a chalkboard rubber at my head when I was 14.
Wow.
I was treated like crap, had no control over my body and my movements, was told what to think, was told how to act. You know, what if actually skipping out on school was an act of self-care? And as soon as I had that thought, I just knew it to be true. And it helped me to look at school refusal, which is very common now, as actual like children trying to advocate for themselves, children putting a line in the sand and saying, actually, no, I deserve to be treated better than this. I'm an autonomous human being. I deserve to have my own thoughts and to be able to express myself. I am not going to put myself into a toxic situation. So I guess I've been sharing the real talk about school over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I really like that. Sorry, my daughter's just walked in, so she's just sitting here listening to the other headphone as well. So we're both listening to you talking. Yes, unschooling in your family, how do you define it for other people? And yeah, how does it look in your family?
So in our family, I don't love the term unschooling because I don't feel like it describes what it looks like in our family. I prefer the term life learning because that is what it's like. Yeah. We see ourselves, every one of us, as life learners. It's not something we do to the children. It is the spirit in which all of us live our life, which is embracing everything that comes to us, stepping into the flow of life and being open to the wonder and awe that we come across. It's about experimenting with how we're living. It's about learning and growing and failing. It's about deep diving into fixation and coming out the other end and sometimes not. It's something all of us are doing together. And it makes for a pretty dynamic kind of way of life.
It's I like how you said it's not, yeah, a different term to the word unschooling. Somebody else I interviewed, Peter Michael Bauer, he called it family integrated rewilding. Like it's a whole family sort of approach.
Totally. I love that. That sounds very professional.
So do you have any sort of set structured learning, or is it exclusively child-led learning in your family, or do you have occasionally do some sort of parent-led teaching?
We are 100% consent-based. Mm-hmm. I don't ever instigate an area of learning because I believe that my children are learning every second of the day. And if they're not learning one thing, it's because they're learning another thing that is more important to them and who they are and possibly even what the world needs. So some of these normal things that people might say, you know, I'm mostly an unschooler, but I just teach reading and maths. That's probably possibly the opposite for how I live my life as a parent to Ramona and Juno. Yeah. Because I think if they're not doing maths and reading, it's because they're doing something that is intrinsically worthwhile for them and their development. Mm. I really believe that. So I would never impose my hierarchy of skills and competencies upon them. So it's completely led by them and completely consent-based. I'm trying to think about if there has been an area where I will instigate conversation. Mm-hmm. So if it feels like there's a topic that is occurring or is floating around our collective field, I will instigate a topic. So, you know, I've spoken about gender rights, and we speak about trans rights, and we speak about racism and Indigenous rights, and we have lots of conversations like that. but it's very much consent based. It's sort of like I might begin it and we might follow along the track of that conversation, as long as it's interesting and as long as everyone is engaged, much as I might just with a friend. You know, if there's something that I'm feeling is really important or exciting, I might begin a conversation with a friend. And if they're into it, then we'll keep chatting. And if not, then, you know, I'm not going to keep pursuing it. So, you know, maybe I'll instigate a few conversations here and there. Both the children as well are part of learning collectives where they meet with other groups of kids and do different topics and different things together. And both of those groups have consent at the heart of them. So, you know, there's no coercive learning. Which is just something I think in general is a pretty bad idea.
I really like some of those words you're using, like pointing out how that hierarchy of, I guess, forced learning or coercive learning, I think it's good for people to see it from that perspective as opposed to going to school and just sitting down and doing what you're told is like the normal thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels wild to me. You know, kids in primary school at the moment, 65% of kids in primary school are going to be doing jobs in the future that don't even exist. But yet we think we know what they need.
Yeah.
And I just find that so strange. And I really feel like that program has not served us well. We've been serving this menu of hierarchical skills to our children for generations. And we just need to look around us and see that that recipe has not taken us to a good place. Yes. And I feel like standing back and let our kids be moved by what is coming up for them, letting them be self-directed, letting them stay in their worlds of imagination and fantasy for much longer than we think is normal. I feel like that is the missing ingredient, really, in terms of being able to create a world that is regenerative and joyful and where people have creative solutions, where people are able to simply be and be present rather than hustling, rather than having to prove their own worth, rather than having to progress a technocracy. I feel like the missing ingredient is stepping back and letting children do what they have identified they want to do and they need to do for as long as we possibly can.
Oh, that's so good. I love those wise words. Now, you seem to be everywhere online. You know, Lucy Atkin Reed Unschooling Support on Facebook, Lulastic blog on Instagram, and your Lulastic and the Hippie Shake website, but you also have a course called Disco. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, thank you, Emily. My Lulastic blog, so lulastic.co.uk, is kind of, there's a lot on there. Yeah. It's where I wrote for like 8 years, almost weekly, but actually I haven't updated that for years now. And I do most of my stuff simply through social media, Instagram and Facebook. And I do also have a YouTube channel called Life Without School, where there are kind of maybe meatier conversations that I'm having, but I guess it depends where people, what kind of content people like to enjoy. So yeah, I kind of am everywhere, I guess. But my course, Disco, it's a 5-week course that people can immediately download if they want to. And it is designed to help people uproot the beliefs that they have inherited around learning. Basically, people find unschooling and self-directed learning really hard because they're walking around with a massive burden of beliefs that they've inherited through their own schooling, their own lives. And these beliefs stop us from leaning into trust. They stop us from experiencing joy in our unschooling lives. So it's kind of designed to identify each person's baggage of beliefs and also to reclaim a new set of beliefs around learning. It's designed to give people confidence. So there's tons of research in there about sort of where unschoolers end up and, you know, whether they end up going to uni and that kind of thing. Mm. We look at the history of education, why it is failing. So it's designed to give people more confidence so they can really experience trust and joy in their unschooling lives.
So this 5-week course, are there set dates for learning as a group, or is it more individual, starting at any time sort of thing?
We do, it depends how you like to learn really. Twice a year, I do bring together a cohort of people. So if people really love chatting with different people from around the world and they really like that kind of conversation side of things, then you can join for the February or the July. So the next one will be July. Live, and that's when I'm doing them live, and there's a lot of conversation in between times. Really fun, really great to feel like you're part of a movement, because there's often a lot of people on the course. If you're like me, I'm the kind of person that just immediately decides they need to learn something right away, and I'll just download like a 10-week course and I'll do it over the weekend. I don't need to chat with other people. I just want the info. If that is your kind of best way of learning, then you can download it all straight away and just self-pace it, kind of self-direct your own journey on that. And you do get access to a group as well. So you can ask me live questions every day if you want to. It's just that I'm not kind of constantly emailing you saying, hey, we're going live tomorrow. Mm. And that's on Disco Learning, discolearning.com.
Oh, so that's another website as well, isn't it? Discolearning.com.
Another one. So much real estate online.
And I like that you cover like your bases for quite a few different sort of genres isn't the word I'm looking for, but you know what I mean. So for your Facebook page, which is Unschooling Support, what sort of ways do you support families to live a life without school?
So I guess I try and have a foundation of information. That's what all of my social media is about giving inspiration to resist what I call the school fixated society out there. People don't recognize this enough, that we live smack bang in the middle of a school fixated society, even though school has not served us well at all, even though society is in a complete pickle. Even though many of us as adults are actually carrying around wounds from school, we still have school at the center of our communities. We still see school as absolutely essential to childhood. So recognizing that we live in a school fixated society and then purposefully trying to undermine that school fixation by hearing stories about different unschoolers, different ways of living, hearing little bits of insight that unschoolers are sharing, just seeing the day-to-day lives of how people live without school, all of that helps undermine the great myth of school. So I guess that's what I see my social media and my YouTube as doing, kind of waving a bit of a flag and saying, there is another way. you can read this story and hear about how I am living and how my community is living. You can know that you don't have to live a life that is enmeshed with school. There is another way. So I guess I see all of my social media as sort of serving unschoolers around the world simply by showing what is possible. Yeah. So that's one side of my work. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of my work is in facilitating workshops that are really big deep dives into our beliefs, into all of the conditioned thinking that leaves us stressed, untrusting, feeling unworthy, feeling anxious and sad. So DISCO is a part of this work, but I also have an unschooling membership, which is sort of monthly deep dives into this stuff. So in the morning, for example, I'm doing a workshop in my unschooling membership. My unschooling membership is called Circle. Mm-hmm. And so my workshop tomorrow in Circle is about deschooling purpose. And we're looking at all the beliefs that we have inherited through our lives about who we are and why we're here on earth and what we should be doing with our time. Because actually those beliefs that we're carrying around with us stop us from connecting with our children. They make us feel constantly harried, having to move from thing to thing, never sitting down because we've got so many chores to do and so many places to go. They make us question what our children are doing. We see them just relaxing and it triggers a thought in our mind about how, they're relaxing too much and we're raising kids that that aren't resilient and, don't know what work is, So it's a kind of massive topic that really stops us from living a totally trustful and joyful life with our kids. So yeah, that's a little bit of an example of the kind of workshop that I love to facilitate. I love to get really deep into all these inherited and conditioned thinking patterns.
So your workshops, they're not just on unschooling, they're almost like on the whole philosophy around sort of children and child raising and rethinking ideas. Have I got that right?
Yeah, they tend to be about how, it's the process of deschooling, which is unlearning everything we have come to believe about ourselves and about life and about parenting. So it is essentially deschooling work, but because all of these beliefs permeate everything we do, the workshops do tend to be quite far-reaching. But I nearly always try and make it specifically about how this belief impacts our ability to thrive within unschooling. Like the deschooling purpose one that we're doing in the morning has a really direct influence on our ability to thrive within unschooling, because if we believe that our purpose here on earth is to sort of be good, something we might have learned, to be good or be perfect or show that we're worthy, to do lots of worthy tasks and not waste our time. If we believe that, then we're constantly rushing, constantly stressed. We don't know that we can rest. We don't prioritize play. We don't prioritize pleasure, having a good time. We don't end up relaxing enough. And so we actually stop being able to thrive. We kind of become dried up husks of ourselves. And at that point, unschooling is not fun. Unschooling is unsustainable. And eventually your kids might even end up back in school, because you haven't dealt with this deep, deep down beliefs that you're holding about purpose. Does that make sense?
Yes, it
hopefully
does.
Hopefully I've kind of shared how they actually are about unschooling, but they're also about these quite gigantic issues or topics.
Yes. And yeah, it does. It does make sense. Before, when you were talking about how we're in a school-centered society, I could just hear this mainstream voice wondering, but if I have to have an operation, I want a surgeon who's been to school. So I just wondered how you would respond to somebody who said something like that.
Yeah, I actually say school fixated instead of school centered. And I say school fixated because I'm trying to pathologize it. You'll notice that we say fixated as a negative word.
True. Yes.
And centered tends to be quite benign and even positive. So yeah, I actually see it as being pathologically school fixated. Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that unschooling would be the perfect route to somebody becoming a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably 50% of the surgeons we have in society probably unschooled their way into that world, in terms of having the internal motivation, identifying the path they wanted to take for their career, and then being highly motivated and enjoying the process. So and then probably 50% of surgeons we have in the world were forced into that profession by expectations and pressure.
Mm.
And they're probably really not enjoying it. They're probably not the best surgeon that you want in charge of the operating table when you head into the hospital tomorrow. I actually think that allowing motivation to be triggered and get people onto a path towards a skill is ideal. It's what we need and what we want in society.
I love that. That was such an excellent answer. Now, are there any other ways to find you online that I haven't mentioned?
No, you've covered them all. Well done.
Great. Okay, Lucy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
It's been lovely to be here, Emily. Thank you for having me. I love talking about all this stuff, and you had great questions.
Good. Now, my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a great question. Controversially, I would not give any message because I think if all information was lost and all humans had was the present moment, I feel like that would be all around better for them.
I so agree. That's like the way to move forward, is without any of the baggage of the past.
I think that's basically what we're all trying to do as adults, is just quieten our busy minds and simply become present and to breathe and to activate the mammal part of ourselves, which is fully able to enjoy every moment.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.